Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
You start the book by posing the question, is there a number at the root of the universe? Which, I have to say, seems like a bizarre question, especially for two people as sophisticated as Pauli and Jung. Why would each of them be so drawn to this question?
Well, Pauli and Jung, as was the case with people into the deep mists of history, looked for a number that was at the root of our being. The main numbers that were considered were the numbers 3 and the number 4, 3 being the Trinity, grew into the Trinity, and 4 the Quaternity, which is even older, since there are 4 seasons, 4 cardinal points of the compass, 4 rivers of paradise, and so on. The number 137 also arose for Jung and Pauli in their discussions, but that number also has roots in the Kabbalah, for example.
So there were both scientific reasons why some people fastened on to this seemingly strange number of 137, but there were also ancient mystical reasons.
Ancient mystical, and that's what amazed the austere physicist Pauli. I mean, it is interesting that this man who by day was an austere Germanic physicist had these occult interests, and he was working along the lines of the occult, even though he didn't know it, until he met Jung and was psychoanalyzed by Jung in 1933 to 1934.
You said he had interests in the occult before then? What kinds of interests?
Interests in that highly creative people have an intense focus to solve a problem. They put a lot of mental energy into it, and they always have somebody who inspired them. And the man who inspired Pauli was the 17th century scientist and mystic Johannes Kepler. Kepler would intersperse page upon page of calculations in his scientific text, which were of a different variety than we have today, with discussions of alchemy, mysticism, religion, and the angst of his everyday life, arguing with his wife whether his children were okay and things of that sort. The number 3 interested him greatly because he was interested in the Trinity, but his work was incomplete, Pauli thought. And indeed, Pauli's great discovery that he made in 1924 concerning the structure of the atom meant a movement from 3 numbers giving the characteristics of electrons in an atom to 4 numbers. Pauli angsted over that. It cost him a great deal of energy. And it was only after his analysis with Jung that he realized that the number, that the transition from 3 to 4, why it was so hard, and what it had to do with his neurosis as well.
Now, you mentioned that Pauli went to Jung for analysis. And of course, by this time, Jung was a renowned analyst, I mean, second only in fame to Freud himself. Of course, had branched away from Freud.
Yes.
Pauli was a brilliant scientist at that time, but quite young still, and much younger than Jung. How did Pauli happen to go see Jung for therapy?
Yes, Pauli was 25 years younger than Jung. Jung was 57 when Pauli went to see him, and Pauli was 32. Pauli went to see him because he had reached a dangerous low point in his life. He was on a binge of drinking, drug, prostitution. He was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. By day, he was an austere physicist. By night, he frequented red light districts. That he was sometimes thrown out of a bar was a mixed blessing because they often got into a brawl in which he was beaten up. Then in 1927, there was the death of his mother. She was a suicide. She was completely humiliated by her husband, Wolfgang Sr., who was an inveterate womanizer, but at that point went too far and left her for a woman his son's age, whom Pauli always referred to as his wicked stepmother. And Pauli was on a binge. His life was going downhill. And it was at that point that he, although he hated his father, he took his father's advice and went to see the celebrated psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who at 57 years of age was actually at the height of his power.
Hmm. So was this encounter useful to Pauli? Did it help resolve some of his emotional turmoil?
Oh, it was enormously useful to Pauli. Pauli was a dreamer. Pauli spent a good deal of time dreaming. When he went to see Jung, he had dreamt 355 dreams, which he had written up, and he dreamt another 45 before the end of their psychoanalysis in 1934. They saw each other for about a year and a half. Jung wrote of Pauli that he felt that Pauli became a calmer person and stopped drinking as well. Well, that wasn't quite the case. Jung and Pauli used to drink together, as a matter of fact, and that Pauli was calmer. Well, to some extent he was, but he had outbursts of fierce cynicism. I mean, Pauli was noted for his extremely cynical remarks, such as, when a person would present them with a theory, he would say, "Why, that's not even wrong," or "So young and so unknown, and you're more interesting drunk than sober."
You mentioned
Jung made an interesting comment about his psychoanalytic work. He said 1/3 of his patients were healed, 1/3 were improved, 1/3, it didn't matter to them at all. Pauli fell somewhere in the middle.
Now, you mentioned that Pauli told hundreds of his dreams to Jung. Were there some particularly powerful dreams?
Yes. The dreams that Jung lectured on. One thing that's interesting about Pauli and must be borne in mind is that Pauli never, ever told anybody, even his very closest associates, that he had been in psychoanalysis with Jung, although many people knew he was friendly with Jung. But he never told them that he was in analysis. The main reason is that he wanted to protect his reputation, his scientific reputation, because Jung's brushes with the occult and his discussions of alchemy had led him into some disrepute in certain quarters. Jung's analysis was of great help to Pauli. In that Pauli was able to realize, for example, why he had struggled so much with his first great discovery. His neurosis was that his, in Jungian psychology, just to take a step back for a moment, Jung's psychology is based on a topology of the mind based on two types, the extrovert and the introvert, terms which Jung brought into the language that we use today. And finer tuned with four basic functions: thinking, feeling, sensation, feeling, and intuition, coupled two at a time. So thinking was coupled with feeling. Pauli was somebody who put all his energy, conscious energy, into thinking, so the feeling function became the inferior one and dropped into the depths of his, the dark depths of his unconscious, and from time to time reverted to its archaic form. And in this way, energy bubbled up from the depths of Pauli's collective unconscious, where his feeling function had dropped down into, resulting in fantasies which caused neuroses. So what Pauli was missing was his fourth function, the same as physics was missing the fourth so-called quantum number to describe the electron. And so Pauli's trouble in physics, in a strong sense, reflected his mental problems as well. And that's one point that he got out of Jungian psychology.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jung, of course, is famous for seeing all kinds of meaning in dreams. I mean, this is the place where archetypes can be called up. We tap into our collective unconscious, or at least so Jung thought. Mm-hmm. What about Pauli's dreams? Were they revealing in any particular way?
Oh, extremely revealing of his searching for his feeling function, and the way to do that is what Jung would do is use a person's dream images and compare the dream images with images from alchemy, taking account of the four basic thinking functions. Jung considered what, in Pauli's case, and in all cases, as a matter of fact, that what the patient has is a dialectical discussion. The patient is involved in the dialectical discussion between the patient's unconscious and conscious, leading to an equilibrium between the two, a centering between the two. That's called individuation. And Pauli's images were extremely strong. For example, Pauli is always associated in conversation with three people, one of whom he ignores. That's his feeling, his feminine side, his feeling function, called in Jungian psychology the anima. And then Pauli finally makes contact with the anima, and at that point begins to draw mandalas. Mandalas are essential in Jungian psychology. And the mandala that Pauli draws is an amazingly complicated one, which Jung has a lot of trouble deciphering. But the main point is that it's driven by a trinity or three rhythms, which are embedded in a fourth. So you have the three embedded in the fourth. And in that way, Pauli finds equilibrium between his conscious and his unconscious. He's achieved the quaternity, so to speak.
Now, we've been talking about Jung's analysis of Pauli, but didn't they also spend many hours together socially and intellectually hanging out at Jung's mansion on Lake Zurich?
Yes, they did. They became, the relationship turned from a patient-analyst relation to a colleagueship and then a friendship. They would meet at Jung's fortress-like house, Gothic-like mansion on the shores of Lake Zurich, and discuss, dine on fine food and smoke the finest cigars and drink the finest wine and speak about topics that range from physics, psychology, UFOs, Jesus Christ, Yahweh, Armageddon, you name it. They talked about it.
Hmm. Now, in some ways, I can understand Jung's interest in this intellectual collaboration, maybe more than Pauli's. After all, Jung was proposing all kinds of radical ideas. He was talking about archetypes and the collective unconscious. He was fascinated by the ancient practice of alchemy, and he wanted to ground some of these ideas in science. And so it was his remarkable good fortune to come across Pauli, this brilliant young physicist. But for a leading physicist to show so much interest in mysticism, that's maybe a little harder to explain. Did Pauli feel that physics had fallen short in some ways?
Yes, he did. Pauli, in contradistinction, one can strongly say, believed that quantum physics was not the end all, which is what Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg felt. Pauli believed that what quantum physics gave you was a mathematical description of nature, of the microcosm. But in order to do that, it has to consider the microcosm as dead matter. But why is it? I mean, how is it that the atoms and molecules that make up our body, although they're considered in quantum physics as dead matter, all add up and give you consciousness, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts? How does that come about? Physics is not set up for that. What one needs is a dose of a strong combination with psychology. And Jung also believed that psychology cannot fit the bill by itself either, because it cannot discuss things like consciousness and synchronicity, that is to say, meaningful occurrences in which a timeline is not straight as it is in Western science, but actually the timeline is more as it is in Chinese philosophy, that's circular. Everything that can happen is out there. You just pluck it out of the air at a certain time. One need not have Western cause and effect.
I didn't realize that physicists were really interested in consciousness back in the early 20th century.
They weren't.
So Pauli was unusual here.
Pauli was very unusual. Now consciousness is becoming more of a bona fide thing to discuss. But I think 10 years ago, people would consider you crazy if you talked about consciousness. But now neuroscientists are talking about consciousness. I mean, we're all concerned with, I mean, how is it that we can, that we have these dimensions of thinking about love, hate, death, and the universe? How does that come about? You know, is the mind in the body? Is the brain in the mind, or the mind in the brain? Where is the brain? How do we think?
I know this is a huge topic of debate for neuroscientists, for philosophers, for certain religious people, but still physicists, they tend not to get into questions of consciousness. There are a few here and there who say that maybe quantum physics has something to do with consciousness, but these are definitely the mavericks out there.
Yeah, there are people like Roger Penrose, for example, at Oxford, who has very interesting ideas about this. And the point is that they do combine concepts of biology with physics. And one of the main points about physics that Jung and other and neuroscientists are interested in is this notion that of Bohr, what was called complementarity by Niels Bohr. It's that the struggle between opposites can be reconciled into a whole. And this is very much a part of alchemy as well. And in quantum physics, it turns out that you can't study a particular system in space and time and expect to have laws of cause and effect hold as well. And Jung was very interested in this because he said, aha, I mean, this is synchronicity here to some extent, namely that there are processes in nature that need not be causal processes.
Hmm. I'm guessing that most scientists would see this intellectual collaboration between Pauli and Jung as interesting, but kind of verging on pseudoscience. And certainly, they would say a lot of Jung's interests were sort of pseudoscience, especially his interest in the occult. Do you see it that way?
When I first started working on Jung and Pauli, yes, I very much did. But then working on it more and more, I began to have more and more sympathy with notions of alchemy and notions of mysticism. They're extremely interesting and should not be pushed aside. One can't use the sledgehammer of rationalism to attack this form of knowledge. There's a lot out there that we don't understand. And clearly the science we have today is not, you know, can't give us that niche of we can't fit in with that. And I always like to think of the situation along the following lines, that 30 years ago, who would have thought that science would look the way it does today? And who knows what science is going to look like 50, 100, 1,000 years in the future, when one will have, for example, fabulous computer architectures.
Well, that's quite a change for you personally, to say that when you first started this project, you thought this was just kind of junk science, and you changed. I mean, to talk about alchemy as a legitimate
pursuit. I never thought I would. what Jung did is extremely interesting, and what I wanted to look more into alchemy as I was reading this book, and so I picked up various books on alchemy written in the 20th century, and lo and behold, I found that they all referred to Jung. And then I fully realized what Jung had done. Jung considered alchemy to be foolish also when he first looked at it. And then it was the symbols that are the thing. And what he did was to, so to speak, fold alchemy into his psychoanalytic theory.
So what made this resonate for you then? I mean, you were a trained physicist.
That's right. Yeah. Rationalist.
Trained rationalist. Yeah. So how did you come to appreciate, I guess, what you might call the more intuitive way of looking at things?
That's right. Well, intuition is a big word. I've been playing with that a lot in my studies of creativity. But basically, looking at alchemy and mysticism, what these people discussed in an extremely intellectual way, and sitting around and talking about truly the nature of things, one, it brings home to you that there's so much out there that we don't know, and that rationalism, cut and dry. I mean, rationalism is good. Rationalism is better than, you know, just obscure mysticism. Rationalism has to be kept. The so-called Enlightenment program must be kept in mind. But there's so much out there that we don't know. There, one should keep one's mind open to combine science as we know it, per se, with other forms of knowing, with physics, with psychology, with biology. This is what these people were pressing. And looking at the level of their discussions and their quest to hold together the world with what they were talking about certainly merits further consideration. And indeed, this is one of the reasons why I wrote this book.
So what is it
to bring what they were doing to a larger audience?
Yeah. So what is it that we don't know? What is it that science cannot explain?
Consciousness, for one thing.
So you're saying brain science cannot explain consciousness. I mean, the study of synapses and sort of what happens inside, you know, neurons and brain cells and all of that.
Science in general, we still can't explain creativity, which is in a sense part of consciousness. And what I'm interested is in questions of that sort. How do we think? How do we feel? How do we talk about ambiguity? I'm not sure that other animals can deal with ambiguity. Ambiguous situations, and dealing with ambiguous situations really came to the forefront with research into quantum physics. And this was another thing that interested Jung, and which Jung and Pauli talked a great deal about, and which also came out of Pauli's dreams. Pauli made other discoveries due to dreaming. And he realized that conscious work during the day can energize archetypes and bring them up and lead you to the creative moment. And the creative moment is right now a mystery unto itself. I think it's a mystery that we can learn a lot more about and in the end, and maybe solve it in the end.
What kinds of discoveries did Pauli make by looking at his dreams?
Well, one was the notion that... for example, we all have characteristics that set us apart from each other, and Pauli made the suggestion that electrons and atoms, no two electrons and atoms can have the same characteristics. And that led to a far-reaching results that explained the structure of atoms, why metals are hard, why certain stars die as they do. Another discovery...
Wait, you're saying that discovery came from a dream?
Not from, well, at that point of time, he didn't know that, I don't think he was dreaming, or he didn't record dreams at any rate, as he did when he came to see Jung. But he came to understand that the problems he had in solving the problem of atomic structure lay partly in his neurosis, which was solved by means of dreams.
But
that discovery he didn't make by dreams per se, but he did discover what's called... The CTP theorem, which says that if you change matter to antimatter, if you flip right and left and you reverse the direction of time, that's known as CTP. If you do them all together, you apply that to the equations of physics, you should get the equations of physics back. The equations of physics should remain unchanged under that operation. And Pauli felt that that was a super mirror reflection. In a sense, it says that we cannot distinguish our universe from one in which antimatter is changed with matter, left and right is flipped, and time is reversed. This whole business of mirror symmetry, how to deal with it, and the problems that can stem from it came from dreams that Pauli had. And further work that Pauli did on what's called violation of mirror symmetry, and then finally his quest with Werner Heisenberg for a so-called unified field theory of elementary particles, which they failed to achieve. Pauli had felt there was great Jungian significance in that, and he was driven. But everything he wrote, as Pauli said, everything he wrote was dictated to him by a symbol he called Director Spiegler, the director reflector, so to speak.
So it sounds like Pauli's intellectual collaboration with Jung had a profound impact on the way he did science.
Oh, yes, it did. Yes, absolutely. And on the way Jung did psychology, too. I mean, one of the things they both got out of this was Pauli always, well, all through their relationship, they both respected each other's fields of knowledge. Pauli respected Jung's delving into the occult, into alchemy, religion. Religion was a big topic which they discussed. And Jung was, of course, impressed with Pauli's knowledge of physics and picked up what he needed from Pauli. And what they both gained was a friendship, a very close friendship, and a profitable insight into a very different way of thinking and of seeing the universe. In fact, Pauli's last words when he died, apparently, was that he wanted to speak with Carl Jung.
Who remarkably outlived Pauli, even though Jung was 25 years older.
By 3 years, yeah.
Yeah. Well, getting back to this number 137, you say both Pauli and Jung were fascinated by this number and yes. saw it as somehow elemental, maybe the cosmic number. And apparently they weren't alone, were they? Weren't there some other physicists who also were fascinated by the number 137?
Oh, yes, very much so. Werner Heisenberg, Richard Feynman. Amongst others.
Feynman, who called 137 a magic number, right?
A magic number, that's right. And where that number comes from, he said, is a mystery that all physicists should be concerned with. It should be what physicists are interested in then and now as well. There are other fundamental constants around as well, other than the fine structure constant, 1 over 137, is to generate these constants from a physical theory rather than put them in by hand. And that was the holy grail for Heisenberg and Pauli through the 1930s, and it still has not been accomplished.
So
137. One other reason why 137 was of great interest to both Jung and Pauli is that it is the sum of the numeric value of the word Kabbalah.
So for the physicists, the goal is still, but was back then also, to find the underlying structure of the universe, to find what might be called the cosmological constants, sort of the things that never change, and some sort of, I mean, as they're trying to figure out this order
right.
to everything.
Right. Pauli and Heisenberg and other physicists then and now believe that numbers are the structure of the universe.
So basically, they're looking for the underlying mathematical formula for the universe.
That's right. A unified theory governed by a single equation, which, so to speak, can be put on a T-shirt.
And did Jung and Pauli go to their deathbeds thinking that 137 had some remarkable quality?
Oh, yes. Yes, it had. It was something that popped up not only in mysticism, but it's also turned out to be a central number in physics as well. And so there had to be something special about that, just as it was about the numbers 4 and 3. Those are the three numbers that they singled out.
And then by a weird quirk of fate, Pauli ended up dying, going to the hospital, and he ended up in room 137.
In room 137, yes. When I was writing the prospectus for this book, I was going to California from London to do some research, and I flew on American Airlines Flight 137.
Were you unnerved at all by that?
Yes, that was really something.
Because didn't Pauli say when he realized he was dying and going into, you know, room 137, oh my God.
He said, I'm never getting out of this room alive.
This is it.
That's right, and it was.
So... when you talk to other physicists today about this Pauli-Jung collaboration and, you know, all this mystical stuff, what kind of response do you get?
Well, they are amazed. Most of them did not know this. The response is, well, that's interesting. Let's think about it. But it's something that they're willing to accept was there. And one had this very important physicist, Wolfgang Pauli, who was doing his research to some extent, whose research to some extent was driven by his delving into mysticism, the alchemy, dreaming, analyzing his dreams with those disciplines, and viewed his creativity as being driven in this way through dreams.
Well, and one thing I find interesting is actually a number of physicists back then. I mean, many of the leading physicists of the day were also interested in mystical matters. Heisenberg was, Arthur Eddington,
yes.
A number of them, in a way that's just not true today, it seems to me.
No, I've written a lot about Eddington. Eddington was, a lot of people thought, you know, wrote in letters to each other that, well, Eddington is sort of crazy, but they read every word that he wrote, and they discussed everything he said. Today, not so, to a large extent. Today, unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is tainted as pseudoscience, and some of it is, but some of it is interesting, as it was in the hands of people like Jung and Pauli. And once again, that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, to bring the level of their discussions, how they talked about it, how they saw it, how they analyzed it, back into the general circle of thinking.
But how do you explain that physicists back then, I mean, back in the 1920s, were so interested in questions of mysticism? And we're not talking just about any physicists here. I mean, we're talking about the major physicists who defined the field that we know today.
I think there were more major physicists then that were curious about the world than there are now, people willing to take chances, people willing to honestly talk about how they think and what they think the world is made of.
That's a rather damning statement
about how physicists think today. I'm not saying all physicists. I'm talking about too many major physicists. Don't let their mind wander. Especially now, when we talk about multiple universes, you know, multiverses, holographic theories of the universe, we throw around terms like the edge of the universe, or maybe the universe is infinite. If the universe is infinite, then there's a non-zero probability that there's a world just like ours. I'm sitting here talking to you, in that other world, I'm sitting here talking to you that also, or in that other world, I couldn't make today's meeting. And what happens then? So, I mean, a lot of way-out subjects are discussed, and I think to some extent, maybe some notions of mysticism should be brought in somehow, here and there.
Well, thank you. This has been fascinating.
Well, thank you.